Welcome to Redacted, everybody. I am Natalie Morris. Clayton is still out for just the rest of the week, so you have me running solo today and tomorrow. I see the comments in the chat speculating that he may be back. I'm sorry to disappoint, but you just have me again. But I got a team with me. I've got David and Philip in the control room, and we have a lot of news to get to today. We have an update on Ukraine's membership light to NATO, and whether or not that means that the war will drag on, what this means for lives, human lives, mostly young men, and what the cost has been for this counteroffensive that really wasn't. So we're going to bring you an update on that. We're also going to talk about Israel. There's been a day of disruption in protest of judicial reform. We have a guest today to explain that. We're also going to talk about a new study that shows that men who self-identify as women into women's prisoners, many of them don't do that until after they've already been convicted of a crime based on male pattern of violence. I know that's shocking, but we're going to provide you that detail. Plus, we're going to go to another platform. Maybe you're already on that platform, but you know where that is. It doesn't rhyme with ShmooTube. We cannot do the last story there because we're going to cover the Peter McCullough story that was taken off of The Lancet. They didn't want to peer review it because that would be inconvenient. Instead, they just pulled it off about the effects of the COVID vaccine, and we're going to tell you what that means. So all that and more as Redacted starts right now. All right, welcome to your Wednesday. Today is is it the 12th or the 11th of July? I have no idea, but it's
the
12th. Wednesday.
The 12th.
In the middle, yes. Okay, so I did half of the show thinking it was Thursday today, and then Philip, who just told us the date for real, had to correct me. So we're getting there. We're getting through it. We're halfway through the year, halfway through the month, and almost all the way through my solo shows, and Clayton will be back with us next week. So thank you for all of your comments and all your watch times and your likes and your shares and all of that stuff. I really, really appreciate it. Thank you to the boys who are supporting me. We have Grim, who never talks except on our text message of the show. We have Philip, who runs the control room, and David, who will show us his face. Davis, show us your face. There he is.
Hello.
All right. So we're rocking the Redacted hat, which I'm going to tell you where you can get that hat if you'd like. You can go to redactedstore.com. But also, if you'd like to get something first that you don't even have to pay for. Oh, that's the store. Yes, you can find things like that to support the show and look as cool as David. I mean, close. The newsletter is something that we write every single day that this show goes out Monday through Thursday. It's supposed to come out in the morning if you are in the U.S. or in the afternoon in Europe. And it is a compendium of your day's geopolitical news. A lot of the things that we talk about here so that you can find those links and read those things for yourself. I don't want you to rely on my analysis by any means. We are free thinkers. You think for yourself. And, you know, we present you with what we think is an interpretation, but we very much appreciate yours too. So subscribe to the newsletter so that you can get those links, read the original sources, and we always appreciate your comments and shares. So, shall we get to the news? Anything you boys want to say before we get going? You want to crack your knuckles? Do a little stretch?
I'm stretched.
Okay. I saw that movie last night, Sound of Freedom.
Oh, yes. I do want to. Okay, let's hear about that before we go. So, let me just remind our audience that Sound of Freedom is the movie about child trafficking that for some reason the mainstream media has said is not worth watching because it supports QAnon theories or validates them in some small way. We went over this on Monday's show. You can rewind the tape if you'd like, but David was able to see it. So go ahead, tell us.
Yeah, no, I thought it was really good, but it is something that you, like, it does mess with you if you, because I don't know, it gave me a completely different outlook on Tim Ballard, that's for sure. Like, I have another level of respect for him. We did an interview with him on the show a couple weeks ago, And seeing what he went through and what he did for these kids was absolutely amazing. I'm not going to spoil anything, but I just highly recommend you go watch it. But be prepared for gut-wrenching. It's very hard to watch if you like kids, because like what they do to these kids is unimaginable. And what's funny is we've been hearing about all this stuff happening all over the country. And the movie was set to start at 7 o'clock, and I got there at like 6:45, and then we sat there. And we were sitting there, and it was about 7:15, and somebody got up and walked out and went to the ticket counter, and they're like, hey, the movie or nothing has started yet. Like, there's nothing on the screen. And they said, oh, yeah, we forgot. And then it was like 7:30, 7:35 before anything even started. So,
that is so
weird. Which meant it was going to be late for the 9:45 people coming in, because we were walking out at 9:45, and that's when it started for the next people. So you know they got to get it, like, reset up and everything, so... You know, it's that just seems too coincidental for that not to be intentional.
That's some malfeasance, I tell you. There's been a lot of reports of malfeasance around that movie. So, okay. Well, I'm glad that you got to see it. Thank you for doing that. Let's just call that on assignment, because I certainly can't go watch that by myself. Maybe I'll catch up in another. If it comes in book form, I'll read it.
You'd better off reading it, because it was hard. It was really hard, because I thought of you a lot actually when I was watching it and thinking, I don't think you should watch this.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah.
I'm a delicate flower when it comes to that kind of stuff. We have a joke around our house that I'll read the most screwed up stuff, you know, books about just awful, awful things, but I won't watch even fiction. I won't watch things that are just too upsetting.
Well, I think it's just because you have kids, and I know how close you are to your kids, and to see kids that, but the girl, the main girl, remind me of Eve a little bit. So that made it like, it was just kind of hard.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks for accepting that assignment. And,
yes. Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's move on to the war in Ukraine, because we got another emotional appeal from Ukraine today after President Zelensky visited NATO. Now, we've shown you many times that every time a world leader or a celebrity visits Ukraine, we get these really highly polished, highly produced videos with like heartstring, emotive music in the background. Today was a big one because he met with all the world leaders of the West. Watch him showing up to NATO summit. And I kind of had this, I can't help myself but make Potter references. It felt like all the world leaders were surrounding him like he's Neville Longbottom, who just kind of put them over the house cup, because they did not offer him full membership, but they allowed him in their club as sort of a junior varsity member. I'm going to play the first part of it. It's about a minute and a half, and then I'm going to go ahead and talk over it, because you don't hear any words until the end. So watch it, and then let's just keep in mind as we watch it, what are we being asked to feel about it with this music? So we see Rishi Sunak, we see Biden, we see President Erdogan, we see Jens Stoltenberg, the head of NATO. We're going to see Giorgia Meloni pop in the white suit as well in a second. Behind her is the Prime Minister of Spain in the purple tie there. And she kind of goes across in the white suit. That's Giorgia Meloni from Italy. Many other world leaders. Now, also yesterday, interestingly enough, on Zelensky's Telegram feed, he posted a video. Can we just pause it there for a second? I'm sorry. He posted a video on his Telegram of him with Mark Rutte, the recently departed Prime Minister of the Netherlands, who on the show on Monday, when he had his surprise resignation, we had Ralf Schollheimer say he's going to show up somewhere else, probably in the lead role in NATO. Huh, he was on Zelensky's Telegram. I forgot to bring that video, but I will bring it another day. And what's he doing there if he was retiring from Dutch politics? Why is he in NATO taking a senior role with Zelensky? Let's go back to the video now, because what we have here is Jens Stoltenberg giving this speech about Ukraine and NATO.
Reaffirmed that Ukraine will become a member of the alliance. And we have made
decisions to bring Ukraine closer to NATO. Today, we meet as equals, and I look forward to the day we meet as allies.
Now, in terms of propaganda, I'm very curious about his decision to still wear this outfit, this green military outfit, because, you know, they say dress for the role you want. He wants to be considered a full-on member of NATO, and for that to happen, he needs to not be at war. But he continues to dress as if he's in active combat, and I feel like that outfit does not fit the occasion, but he's acting, and we know this. Go ahead, David.
Yes. I was going to say, I feel like the piano music really, really got to me. But I feel like that, you know, real quick, you know what that reminded me of? You ever see the Truman Show where they're like, where he's getting ready to hug the father and they're like, okay, easy on the music. All right. Now he's coming in for the hug. Swell, swell, swell. And then they're like sitting there and then he hugs his father and the music goes, you know, louder and crescendos. That's what that felt like. But I think that it's like Fetterman. He looks more approachable and everything in that shirt. So I think that is very, very strategic that he always wear that so that they feel like, you know, this is a man that is like, you know, he's not a man of wealth. He's not a man of anything, but he cares so much.
That's BS. He is a man of wealth, but okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh yeah. But they don't want you to know that.
Right. But what's hinging around their application is that you're currently at war. We can't have someone that's currently at war as we progress through this because that means the rest of us are at war. But he still insists on dressing like he's at war, even though we know he's not at war. He's leading his people into war, but not himself. And so this costuming is something that I find very perplexing. You know, it's like when world leaders sort of march with their troops and you know that they never were in any kind of real battles. Now, again, you know, what he's doing here is some pretty good acting because we know that Zelensky was pissed about the arms distance offer that NATO had offered, and we're going to circle back around to that in a minute. But first, we want to check in on the counteroffensive in Ukraine and just how many lives it has cost and for what purpose. Now, when we started really tracking the counteroffensive with maps, we really in earnest on this show started to show you the maps regularly. The first map I have in my notes is June 1st, and it looked like this. Now, again, here's what we're looking at. The red parts here are controlled by Russian military. That's the Donbas. That is the area that the Ukrainian military has been attacking since 2014 after the Maidan coup. Those people asked Russia to come in and annex them just like they had Crimea, and Russia did not until last March of 2022. Since that has happened, those people have held an official referendum and voted on average of 90% to become a part of Russia. Now Russia is holding that line, so Ukraine can no longer get in there and bomb those people like they have been for the last 10 years. That's the line where we started being told there's a counteroffensive. So what the West wanted us to think was that this red would disappear, would be pushed right, and it would turn this, let's say, light gray color. The dark gray color is the area that is still the Donbas, does still want to be taken over by Russia, but Russian troops haven't been able to advance there. So that's still contested territory. Okay, now let's look a month and a half into what the map looks like today. And this is what we've shown you. Does it look similar? Does it look like maybe those two things, like nothing's happened in 6 weeks? Well, let's go ahead and put them side by side. Yes, that would be absolutely correct. So 6 weeks of a counteroffensive and barely any land gained. By some sources, they have gained about 50 square miles, which is not even 1% of that area. And some experts say it wasn't really ground regained. It was just that they moved forward in land where Russian defenses were not. And how much did that cost Ukraine in terms of human lives and equipment? A ton. These numbers come from the Russian Defense Minister, Sergei Shoigu, but Ukraine has not been forthcoming with the numbers, so this is all we have to go on for right now. This was his official statement just today. That doesn't look good on your screen. I apologize. I won't do that again. I'm just going to read it to you. So what he is saying is 26,000 servicemen, more than 3,000 items of military hardware, 21 planes, 5 helicopters, 1,244 tanks and other armored vehicles, 17 German-made Leopard tanks. Remember those German Leopard tanks that they didn't want to send in the first place? and then did anyway, 17 of them blown to smithereens, 5 AMX tanks produced by France, 12 U.S.-made Bradley infantry fighting vehicles, 91.4 special automotive equipment, 2 air defensive systems, 25 multiple launch rocket systems, 403 field artillery cannons, and mortars. That's a lot.
Do you
guys think
maybe that's, is it 914 or 91.4 vehicles? I think
Sorry.
It's 914.
It's 914. You're right. Sorry about that. I won't do that again. I just wanted to show you the official source.
Good.
I have to find a better way to graphically represent that to you. I'm sorry. Okay. Yes, that's a lot of gear. A lot, right? But what I'm mostly interested in, yes, it sucks if you're a taxpayer in a Western country that's spending your tax money to send those things just to be blown up to make s'mores. The worst part of this here is the 26,000 servicemen. So if we consider that this has been a 6-week counteroffensive thus far, that's an average of about 4,300 deaths per week with virtually no territory recovered. What are those lives worth, I ask you? Is it the ego of Westerners that will not allow this war to go to peace talks? Because that's absolutely shameful. Lives for egos. It's no wonder why Western countries don't want to join this war, but it is a wonder why they seem to continue to support it. Again, I think it's worth noting that this is Russia holding the line so that the civilians who live there will no longer be attacked. Those people asked Russia to defend them from attacks starting in 2014, and Russia did not until just last year. So if you are supporting Ukraine in this war, you are for if you say, well, if Russia just goes home, leaves that territory, then you're for these people to continue to be attacked by Ukraine.
And it also just shows you that this is a money laundering scheme at the end of the day, because those things have been paid for by all these countries. And we know that it doesn't cost as much as they charge the government for those tanks, those weapons and all that stuff. It's sent over knowing that it's going to be destroyed and they're going to have to make more, which means more money for the contractor. So it's just a circle of money, and they don't care about those people's lives. They're going to lose, you know, we send over, $10 billion worth of equipment. We lose some lives, but we replenish it, you know, and act like we're on board with it. I mean, it's just like at the end of the day, it's like the perfect money laundering system for the war contractors.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. The equipmentry, it's a racket. We know that. But the idea of other people's relatives being thrown at this line, when the argument is, no, there's no peace unless Russia gives that up. Well, then if Russia gives that up, those civilians there in the Donbas will go back to being terrorized by the Ukrainian military, which we know they have been doing since 2014. If we say, you know, oh, no, they need to keep continuing to attack Russia holding this line, then you're throwing innocent lives at this line in order to hopefully break it so that innocent lives on the inside can get hurt. That's ludicrous and it's stupid. And you only buy that if you're buying war propaganda. Some will say like, oh, but we can't let Russia have this territory. That's not up to you unless you're a voter in that region. If you get to decide who holds those borders, then the people in those regions should vote in your territory. How about that? And let's recall that, again, the Western media knew that look at the date on this article is 2014, I believe, or 2016, 2014.
Yeah, 2014.
Yes, thank you. Saying that, I'm really killing it with my graphics today, that Russia, when Russia annexed Crimea, the people in the Donbas hoped they would be next. They waited in a long line. Now, tomorrow, we're going to have a segment with journalist Mike Jones, who visits the Donbas regularly and also Crimea. And he's going to tell us just how dispiriting this is for Ukrainian soldiers. We've seen many instances of them just surrendering to Russia in absolute terror and fear. Here is just one example that was shared this week. This is Russian soldiers. What they're doing right now is dropping flyers, instructing these soldiers that if you peacefully surrender, we will take care of you. And that is happening. Now, this is subtitled. I'm not going to read it to you, but if you're not watching, you'll just have to go back around to it later. But watch this, these Ukrainian troops radioing in according to the instructions on the flyers.
Не разобрал, повтори, кто вы, где вы находитесь. Я командир отделения. Мы со 128-й бригады. Вы нас скидывали, на нас скидывали в листовки с этой частотой. Нас 8 человек. Находимся в лесополосе, в серой зоне. Отправили закрепиться и ждать подхода других. Другую группу накрыли на подходе. Они не прошли. Вы тоже накрыли. У нас 5-300, двое тяжелых. Вы нас откроете артой. Мы тут зажаты. Мы не хотим воевать. Мы сдаемся. Прием.
Где, в какой посадке вы находитесь? Прием.
Я не знаю, как объяснить. Мы вышли через позиции другой роты. Я не знаю. Там две машины сгоревшие. Перед ними как бы лесополоса начинается в вашем направлении. Прошли чуть за середину, наверное. По нам минометы работали. Вот, 20 хвилин назад. Прием.
Okay, so we can end it there. It keeps going on. And what they're doing is giving away their position so that they can come and rescue them. So this is Ukrainian soldiers speaking on their radio into Russian soldiers, according to the instructions that they saw in the flyers, asking them to be saved. These are not hard to find if you look for them, but the Western media will not show them to you time after time after time because they're scared. And they know that they are not trained for battle up against the behemoth that is the Russian military. And they also know that Russia is going to hold this line for as long as they can. Again, you know, I see comments in the chat like, you know, Russia should end this war. They continue to offer peace talks, which the West continues to rebuff. And now Zelensky has put forth this total crap line about we'll go to peace talks when we can have Crimea back. Crimea absolutely didn't want you. They were preparing for independence, to fight for their independence after the Maidan coup with shovels. That's how much they didn't want to be a part of Ukraine. So that's a non-negotiable. Russia is not going to hand that back. If anything, Russia would agree to Crimea's independence before they would agree to allow those people to go into the horrible fate that the Donbass has suffered for the last 10 years. So that's just a line. That's just a crap line to prevent peace talks. And now, because the West has decided to use cluster ammunition, Russia is saying, we will too then, if that's what you really want. Here is today, Russian Minister Sergei Shoigu warning that if the U.S. uses cluster munitions, Russia will have to do that too. This means that the West is bringing more destruction upon these soldiers by raising the stakes that are already too high in human lives.
You know, I just want to point out that if it wasn't for independent journalists like this channel, like many independent journalists pointing out the fact that the U.S. is sending cluster bombs, the West would not even know. The majority of people would not know that was happening. And then when Russia used them in counter to us using them that they wouldn't know here, then we would be like, oh, Russia's using cluster bombs. That's a war crime. We got to go in. You know what I mean? It's like, fortunately that there are independent journalists out here that can catch that narrative before it gets used as propaganda to want people to go in. They'll still use it. They'll still say Russia used cluster bombs first or something like that, I'm sure. But
and I don't think they should
secretly send that stuff. No,
right.
They shouldn't.
No,
and they don't want to.
I don't think this. You know that this. You know, if you do this, we're going to have to do it too. I don't think that's an argument that I accept. You know, two wrongs don't make a right, and two war crimes definitely don't make a right. I do not want to see this escalated into cluster bombs on either side, for the reasons that we showed the other day about the video that 40% of those bombs don't detonate, and they just sit there waiting for somebody to walk by them, some innocent civilian. So this is absolutely an unacceptable escalation that we hope, even though the West is raising the stakes, that Russia doesn't see those stakes and raise them. So what will happen next, given that now NATO has given a junior varsity agreement to Ukraine to keep them in the fight? It's hard to say, because Ukraine does not believe and feel that NATO has its back anymore. Recall last week, the U.S. ambassador to NATO, Julianne Smith, said, you know, we're going to make them an offer that makes them believe and feel something above and beyond restating Bucharest. Bucharest was a 2008 summit when they gave them a sort of someday commitment. So they're supposed to be believing and feeling something better. They don't, though, according to President Zelensky's Telegram channel. I was not able to give you a graphical representation of this in English, so I'm just going to give you the screenshot and tell you what it said, according to my translator. He, on his way to this NATO summit, saying, Ukraine deserves respect, and NATO is not putting any respect on his name. He put on a good show today, but he still was pretty pissed off about it, saying that this is unprecedented and absurd are the words that he used. But it seemed to be sufficient enough to allow both sides to save face so that he can keep showing up for the cameras and doing what the West wants him to do, which is looking like a war hero and selling this war to you. But how much longer can the media sell this war for Western governments? I thought I'd end with this segment, which is sort of making the rounds on social media. This is Roseanne Barr, who is a Jew with Ukrainian heritage, and she's speaking out about the war on Piers Morgan this week. And watch how he really does not want to get into it, and is kind of shocked that he invited someone. He invited her on to talk about free speech and comedy and freedom of expression. And you can tell, you know, he was not prepared to be challenged on the media's narrative about Ukraine. Now, I'm going to warn you, because I do get notes sometimes about language. I am watching my language. I am trying to. Roseanne Barr does not. So if you don't want to hear some strong language, you can mute for about, how long is this video? About three minutes and 3 seconds. Here you go. You've been warned.
I look at the sort of apoplexy that people bring to jokes, to humor, to sarcasm, to irony, all these things. And I really despair. The very essence of comedy, for example, is being expunged from human life.
Yes, it is. Yeah, well, you should despair, Piers, and so should anybody who has a brain or, you know, any humanity whatsoever, or any connection to any other human beings on earth, they should despair too. I say that they are weaponizing stupidity, and people have sunk to such a level that they can't handle satire, because satire is when you take two disparate subjects and bring them together to defamiliarize reality, such as a poet does with words. Defamiliarize reality. And they cannot hold two disparate ideas in their head at the same time, because they're fed bullshit 24/7 over the media. And I'm about to go crazy sitting here on the earphone hearing the stuff you all are saying about the Ukraine. I'm about to have a heart attack, but I'm not even going to go into it. I'm from the Ukraine. There is a large faction of Nazis. I don't know if you know this, but there's a large amount of Nazis in the Ukraine, and they actually killed my whole family. I'm from the Ukraine, and they marched my entire family, grandmothers, great-grandparents, siblings out into the forest and buried them alive in the Ukraine. So I don't understand why everybody's Ukraine. Well, I do understand, and that's also what terrifies me. People better wake up and do some research on their own instead of buying what comes across on the screen. And I try to shake them up, Pierce. You're goddamn right I do. I try to shake them up and crack their mind control programming. I do it for God.
Well, here's, Roseanne, what I would say to that. I don't agree with you about a lot of the stuff you said about Ukraine. I know what you said, and you're perfectly entitled to your views. I would say, in relation to the suggestion that they're all a bunch of
you
Nazis...
You haven't seen the swastikas on those soldiers' arms.
The President Zelensky himself is Jewish, so obviously he is de facto not a Nazi.
I know, but he's not a good one. Are all Jews the same? For God's sake, talk about anti-Semitic. Just because the guy's a Jew doesn't mean he likes Jews or that he's doing anything good for the Jews. I mean, so what? Who cares what anybody is? That was the whole point of my tweet. Just because they're skin folk don't mean they're kin folk, you know what I mean? Just because they're the same color as you don't mean they ain't trying to lock your ass up. Wake up, people! Snap out of it!
All right. Now, I myself was not prepared to have my opinions disrupted by Roseanne Barr. I bought into the Russiagate scandal in the early 2000s and stopped watching Roseanne because she presented, like, you know, Trump Russiagate as a joke, but like as this, I didn't think it was funny. And I was like, oh, I can't. And now I'm like, well, upside down is right and left. And I love how here he's telling her that her family being killed is her opinion. Like, oh, I respect that opinion. That's not an opinion. That probably happened to her.
Opinion on that.
Yeah, like my family was murdered by these people. Well, I don't agree with your opinion on that. Like that,
right.
That wasn't an opinion. That was not an opinion.
I would say no. That's not an opinion. Go ahead, David. What were you going
to
say?
Well, I was just going to say it's like saying like I had a hamburger that had a worm in it, and you take it to the company, they're like, we don't agree with you that's a worm. Like I'm holding the worm.
Right. Yeah. You know, and she's not saying, what she's saying is you're selling this war and I don't understand how people take it. And he's like, that's an opinion, but she's not trying to debate him and he's not giving a reason why we should support Ukraine. It's it's very paradigm shifting for me. And I applaud the fact that she said those things and I'm going to have to give her a second chance because I was fooled by the Russiagate stuff, and that turned me off her comedy. And now I'm going to have to reexamine everything, guys. Everything. Also, I saw a funny meme online that I thought I'd share with you that, like, who, if someone had told you 15 years ago that Roseanne Barr would look better than Madonna, you'd be like, right, how did that happen? Also, that's apropos of nothing, but it made me laugh. Go ahead, David.
Well, I was just going to say, it's like these people have this strong opinion of Ukraine, talking to someone from Ukraine, and they've never been anywhere near there. Like a lot of these people don't know anything about Ukraine. They've never been there. They've never seen anything. They probably don't even watch any independent journalists to see what exactly is going on over there. They don't care. They're just talking heads that just push a narrative and, you know, so they never have an argument. It's
or read
just
a book
like,
rewind the tape anything. On like read mm-hmm. back media reports for the last 10, 15 years, any of that. You're absolutely right. Thankfully, you know, there are people who have been sharing about this for much longer than just March of 2022, when all of a sudden we all became aware that Ukraine existed. So anyway, let us know what you think of that in the chat. The counteroffensive, Roseanne Barr, Madonna. Any of those things. If you'd like to tell me about any of those things, I'm all ears. Giving comedians a second chance because you were once an idiot, a woke idiot, and now you're not. Or is that just me? So let me know what you think of those things. We have a lot more news to get to. We're going to talk about the Day of Disruption in Israel and how Israelis are protesting judicial reform. These were massive protests and have been for weeks. What does this mean for Israel? We have a guest today to explain it, and I'm excited to bring you our new guest named Emily Schrader. We also are going to talk about a new report that shows that some male prisoners pretend to be transgendered in order to be transferred into women's prisons. You don't say. I know you're shocked. We also are going to go over this new COVID study by Peter McCullough that talks about some adverse events that you don't wake up from. About a certain type of vaccine. That is not something we can present on YouTube. So if you're already on Rumble, we will stay put. If you are not on Rumble, we will not stay put if you pick up what I'm putting down. So all of that is coming up. But first, if your business earns millions or tens of millions in revenue, stop what you're doing and take a listen because NetSuite by Oracle has just rolled out some of the best offers we've ever seen. NetSuite gives you the visibility and control you need to make your decisions faster. And for the first time in NetSuite's 25 years as the number one cloud financial system, you can defer payments of a full NetSuite implementation for 6 months. That's no payments and no interest for 6 months, and you can take advantage of this special financing offer. NetSuite is the number one platform because they give your business everything you need in real time and all in one place to reduce manual process, boost efficiency, build forecasts, and increase productivity across every partner. Now, we can't do what we do on this show without support of companies like this, and it is increasingly brave of companies to reach out to independent media, and we really appreciate it. So they're supporting us, and we'd appreciate it if you'd support them by heading on over to netsuite.com/redacted. If you've been sizing up NetSuite, and it's time to make the switch, and you know this deal is unprecedented, no interest, no payments, take advantage of this special financing offer at netsuite.com/redacted. That's netsuite.com/redacted to get the visibility and control you need to weather any storm. Once again, that's netsuite.com/redacted. Well, on Tuesday in Israel, it was declared a day of disruption with protesters blocking roads and airport routes. The movement was in protest to a new reasonableness standards bill that passed in its first reading on Monday night. The bill will hand more power to politicians by preventing courts from reviewing legislation according to this new reasonableness standard. Currently, courts can review decisions by elected officials according to this standard, but if this bill becomes law, it will essentially kneecap that process. Joining me to discuss this is journalist Emily Schrader. She is an Israeli and is also an American, and she joins us from Tel Aviv. So thank you for joining me. First of all, did I get that right, or is that an incorrect interpretation of what this is?
Mostly right. Just a little bit more specifically, this is part of a series of judicial reforms that have been proposed by this Israeli government. So this is just one of many. And this particular one has been one of the major sticking points in the proposed reforms because it does limit the court's ability to review decisions made by the government. Now, interestingly, this actual clause, the reasonableness clause, is what they're canceling in the court. And that gives the court the power to determine whether or not the decision of a government official, such as a minister, or their appointees or their policies they're proposing would be considered reasonable by an average person. So under this new legislation, that clause giving the Supreme Court the right to review those kinds of decisions would be canceled. Now, the controversy over this is that it can be misused by giving the legislative branch so much more control. You have problems that could arise, such as, for example, Aryeh Deri, who is a former minister in the Israeli government that was convicted of bribery and actually has a felony conviction against him. And this government wanted to appoint him as the Minister of Finance, for example. So the court said that it would be unreasonable that someone who is a convicted felon who has committed financial crimes would be in charge of handling financial matters in the state of Israel. So that is what the reasonableness clause was for from the beginning. And the concern is that any government, whether they be far left or far right or even, you know, centrist, could push through policies that impact not only who certain ministers will be, who will hold those portfolios, but also in certain policies that they're promoting. It could also occur that a minister, sets a certain budget aside for a certain community or a certain group of people that the court would say that's unreasonable to, you know, have such great disparity in wealth between one community next to the other. And of course, this is hypothetical, but it makes it more, makes the country more susceptible to corruption. And so I think that that's one of the main concerns from the protesters that we're seeing over this issue.
Okay, so would this be akin to, say, the Supreme Court no longer being able to review a constitutionality of law, which is something we do see happening in the U.S. and I think many of us want to continue to happen?
So it's a little bit more complex than that because Israel doesn't have a constitution. And for me personally, it's one of the reasons that I have erred against these judicial reforms. On certain pieces of legislation, I do also actually agree that the power of the Supreme Court should be reformed slightly. Mm-hmm. But I do not support these particular reforms for the reasons that I already mentioned in this.
Okay.
The reasonableness clause and the other proposed reforms won't do away completely with the Supreme Court's, at least as they stand today, the proposals today. They won't do away completely with the court's ability to review legislation in certain circumstances, but it does limit how judges are selected, which is actually one of the positions that I agree with for the judicial reforms. And of course, it limits the power of the court to be able to check the legislature. And that is something that I fundamentally disagree with, precisely because Israel does not have a constitution. Mm-hmm. So it's important that you have someone else enforcing checks and balances. when it comes to a system such as this. Obviously, in my personal opinion, the best solution would be making a constitution, but that becomes incredibly complex, especially in a young country like Israel that has such diversity of thought, opinion, religion, history. So it's that could be an ongoing long-term goal. But as it stands today, I do think it's important that the court has independence and the ability to review decisions of any government, whether I agree with the government or not.
Right. That is an existential question. How in the year 2023 do you come across making a constitution that fits for everybody? Like how was it ever done? Can you give me a temperature of the disruption as it stands right now? I know this is anecdotal, but I did have one friend say, it feels very tense. It feels like it may be a revolutionary time in Israel. Is that an extreme interpretation, or do you feel that too?
I don't think we're anything like a revolution. I think it's interesting. You know, a lot of people criticize Israel for whatever shortcomings the country may have, but sure, this entire demonstration is actually a display of how much Israelis care about the democratic process, how much they care about checks and balances. So really, no matter what side of the aisle you fall on this issue, it's a win for Israel when it comes down to it. The demonstrations have been going on for, you know, over 27 weeks now. And they have been largely peaceful without a lot of altercations here and there. There have been, you know, incidents with certain individuals and the police, but by and large, these are very peaceful protests. And I think that is actually quite impressive and quite a testament to Israel's commitment and efforts towards freedom of speech. I'm not sure that the tensions between the different groups are obviously very, very tense right now. I would say it's worse when it comes to diaspora relations than I have seen it in the past 10 years, at least 10 years since I've lived in Israel. And by diaspora, I mean the communities in the United States, Israel's relations with other countries. This government has made it more difficult, not even necessarily with the decisions that have been made, but with some of the comments that are, you know, extreme, in some cases racist, and just completely unnecessary in many other cases. That is making it more challenging on the ground and making the situation more tense. Now, this polarization isn't unique to Israel. Unfortunately, we're seeing the same type of polarization surrounding political debates all over the world, that the left is getting more extreme and the right is getting more extreme at the same time in response. And somehow we have to have a sort of civil de-escalation. There are already groups that are working on this, that are working on, you know, mutual respect and understanding and dialogue, the importance of dialogue. So I don't think that there will be any kind of, at least in the immediate future, any kind of, you know, civil war or violence over these issues. I do think it will be peacefully resolved. That being said, tensions are extremely high right now. And I think that anytime you have a major change or an attempt to make a major change in the very structure of something like the judicial branch, it's not unusual to have a lot of very passionate opinions about what's happening and a lot of people fighting very hard, frankly, on both sides. I also want to add, it's important, I think, that people understand outside of Israel that the majority of the country statistically does support some kind of judicial reform. As I stated earlier, I think that as a result of not having a constitution, a number of different factors from previous governments, the power of the Supreme Court has gone to somewhat disproportionate levels, especially when you compare it to the judicial branches of other countries like the United States. And a lot of people don't realize that. So I do agree with curbing the court somewhat. But at the same time, I don't agree with this legislation. I think it goes too far. And I also think the way that it's been presented and the way that the opposition in the government has been treated when it comes to this issue is problematic. I think from the beginning, the government should have said this is a decision that should be made with the coalition and the opposition. And I know there have been some relatively unsuccessful you know, conversations between the opposition and the coalition prior to this for the last few weeks. But the opposition isn't very happy with the seriousness of the coalition and working together with, you know, the other parties and the other viewpoints on the issue of judicial reform. So it's an ongoing challenge, and I think it will continue to be. The tensions on the ground with the protests, I mean, we had protests in 10, 11 different cities at least, hundreds of thousands of people, a lot of disruptions. Many of the freeways were closed for, you know, a few hours at a time and then reopened after the police, you know, moved the protesters off of the roads. Ben Gurion Airport also was a major center for the protests. Unfortunately, we did see some altercations between police and protesters there at the airport. Personally, I don't agree with shutting down roads or airports in protest, even though, of course, I respect and, as I stated, agree with many of the positions of the protesters. So there has been some issues with that. But I will say that having announced that they were going to have a day of disruption actually limited the amount of disruption that they had, because the roads were relatively empty because nobody wanted to drive on them thinking that they would be closed. Right. So it wasn't, practically speaking, it wasn't quite as bad as maybe a lot of people anticipated. But the impact of these protests has been immense. I mean, everyone is talking about it. Everyone is paying attention. And in that regard, I think it's successful, because this is a very serious legislative decision that's being made that impacts the entire system. So I do think that people should educate themselves and be aware of what's happening, whether they agree with it or not.
Yes. And your point is well taken, that diplomacy is not always in the best interest of the people. We saw just this week, the Biden administration said that Prime Minister Netanyahu has an extreme cabinet, especially as it relates to Palestinians. So, you know, we see here that the U.S. response to these protests and judicial reform may not actually be what's in the best interest of the people. So what do you think then of the U.S. response, and what do you think ultimately will happen with this judicial reform?
I do think that some form of judicial reform will be passed. It remains to be seen what the end result will be. I am very hopeful, not optimistic, but hopeful that they're able to compromise a little bit on some of the reforms that they are wanting to push through. When it comes to the U.S. response and the U.S. approach to this issue, I think it's been relatively unhelpful. And that is because, you know, Israel is a sovereign country. They make their own decisions. They make their own legislative decisions. They make their own democratic decisions in what government they elect and they build. And I don't think it's appropriate for Biden to be pressuring Israel about how to run their own legislature and their own judicial branch. That being said, that doesn't mean I agree with the government here either. I think Biden's comments were in the context of comments that also expressed, you know, support for a two-state solution and a desire for a peaceful resolution. I'm not sure they were specific to the issue of judicial reform. However, I agree with him that some of the more extreme ministers have been extremely problematic. They've historically promoted racism against Arabs, which, by the way, are 20% of our population, of our Israeli population.
Yeah, we don't. We're not usually reminded of those things. You're right. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a great reminder.
It's important to. Important to remember that, you know, these people are supposed to be representing Israel, but a good portion of our society isn't even Jewish, and we want them to be a part of this democracy. So it's problematic when you have ministers who, even if it's in the past, have built a career saying things that are arguably incitement. And I think that is probably what President Biden was referring to. And while it's one thing for me as a private citizen to say something like that, it's also something else for the President of the United States to say something like that. And at the same time, we're dealing with so many issues, and we being both the United States and Israel, when it comes to Russia, to China, to Iran, it's unhelpful. That's the way I would characterize it. It's unhelpful at best to have the president making comments like that at a time like this. Really, if he has a problem with different Israeli ministers, then he should invite Prime Minister Netanyahu to discuss these issues face to face and talk about it then. To do that in the press, in the international media, is a bit problematic and kind of, to me, screams as a political move. And that, I don't think the U.S.-Israel relationship should be used as a tool for partisan politics or for promoting specific positions. I mean, this is an allyship that has lasted for decades that mutually benefits both countries. And so I don't think that those comments were helpful at all, no matter how true they may actually be on the face of the words he actually used.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for this context. It helps a lot because, you can't believe everything you read in the media or everything you see on Twitter. And so I appreciate your perspective.
Unless it's my Twitter, and then you can.
Okay. All right. So yes, follow Emily on Twitter. It's Emily K. Schrader. We will continue to follow the progress of these protests as they come. So thank you again for your time.
Thank you.
All right. So let us know what you think of that in the chat. And if you're in Israel, send us what your experience is of this day of disruption. There were some, I just want to make it clear that we follow certain rules here on YouTube and other platforms that, we can't show a lot of like people dragging each other around. It did seem like a lot of the footage that we saw out of this protest was peaceful. But anytime... These are just sort of the rules that we follow. Anytime someone's been like dragged along, for instance, a lot of those Just Stop Oil protests, we just can't show those to you. Those are the current rules of engagement.
Yeah, and it's really because the way YouTube says it is like it's this violent police action can get you like it, and it, they'll still play it, but it'll demonetize the video. Yeah. So it's like you got to watch like but then some things are violent police action and some things aren't. And there's some videos that actually just get flagged automatically. Like we had one a while back where it was Dutch protesters, and it was just like, no matter what I did to it, blur it, anything like that, they just, once YouTube recognized that video, it just automatically rejected it.
Yeah, it's kind of strange. These are the rules that we're dealing with. So anyway, let us know what you think of that story and any perspective that you might offer. We appreciate it. We have more news to get to. We're going to talk about this new study out of UK prisons that shows that many male prisoners are pretending to be transgender in order to be transferred into women's prisons. Plus, we are going to go over the new Peter McCullough COVID study that has been removed by The Lancet. They would not even peer review it, even though it was submitted for peer review. That's not how that's supposed to work in academics. Why are they afraid of taking a look at those studies? They're saying they have a problem with the methodology, but they have plenty of studies on their publication right now that use this same methodology. So that's weird, right? Weird. But first, we want to tell you about our friends over at Moomoo. Are you an investor looking for an easier way to trade stocks? And would you like 20 free stocks? Well, with Moomoo, which is our favorite trading platform, there's no steep learning curve. It has a simple interface and it's easy to use. So even beginners can take advantage of the stock market in no time. Plus, it offers powerful tools often reserved for experienced investors like customizable watch lists and advanced charting capabilities. And now Moomoo even has added powerful earnings calendar schedules, so you don't have to hunt and peck to try to find the earnings schedule of your favorite company. Right now, Moomoo is giving away this limited time offer of 20 free stocks when you open your account and make your additional initial deposits. We have their 16 free stocks. I'm not sure which one it is. Let me double check that for you. But even if you never do anything else with your account, you get to keep those free stocks. Between 16 and 20, which is pretty stinking good for free. Moomoo has zero commission trades, and the app looks amazing on every platform, for iOS to Android, Windows, and Mac. Moomoo can help you trade with its advanced tools like their stock screener and their earnings calendar. So no matter what level your skill is, you'll find fantastic tools that can help you trade. So open your free Moomoo account today. Get access to zero commission trades and 20 free stocks when you open your account and make your initial deposits. To learn more, check out redacted.inc/Moomoo. One more time, that's redacted.inc/Moomoo. All right, well, a new report in England shows that some male prisoners pretend to be transgender in order to be transferred into women's prisons. You don't say. This is something that people have been warning about. Now, this seems like kind of an obvious study, but there's some things in here that make me very uncomfortable, and I want to go over it because this is something that affects single-sex spaces, not just prisons, but civil rights as well, things that we all should care about. So if you're like, well, who cares what happens to prisoners? One, you still have civil rights, even if you are a prisoner. And two, this has implications for all single-sex spaces. So let's go over this. Now, the full report hasn't been published yet, but it was commissioned by the Ministry of Justice in the UK, and preliminary findings were published by a prisoner's publication called Inside Times. Now, interestingly, this study was commissioned in order to study how to better protect transgender prisoners. It had nothing to do with protecting women's prisoners or women's spaces. It literally was there to study how to better serve their needs. So that's where that money went. But what they found is that there is this idea of real trans people versus fake trans people. And you can see this conundrum, right? We're talking about biological males identifying as women. And it's really tricky concept to say some of them are real and some of them are not. Now, there is a pathology for gender dysphoria that normally happens in young boys as young as 4. And 80% of the time, it resolves itself by full puberty. If it does not and it persists, a lot of times this is a male, a biological male phenomenon more than it is a biological female phenomenon. So there is such a thing as an adult person who still is gender dysphoric and wants to live as this. So we are talking about two real categories, but what many of them are saying is that these biological males are faking it. Why this matters is because it says that the type of people who are more likely to switch genders are sex offenders. Look at this quote from the study. The figures show that men jailed for sexual offenses are twice as likely to identify as trans women compared with men jailed for other types of offenses. Now, you would think it's just kind of obvious. If they committed their sexual crime with their penis, they should stay in a male prison, right? If they committed that crime as a male, they don't get to then switch. That seems pretty stinking logical. If when they were convicted, let's say a transgender adult who has been dysphoric since childhood and maybe was doing sex work or other kind of like whatever, for whatever they're in prison, drug offenses or something like that, but that happened as a woman, then we are talking about two distinctive groups. Again, this tracks with a 2020 study that shows that transgender women, we're talking about biological males, still display a male type pattern of criminality, because women's violence is very different. Can we put that chart up? If you take a look at this study from 2020 that shows that, so male sexual predators might want to be in spaces with only women. Who would have thought? Oh, maybe everyone who understands sexual predators. Some of the fakers, they say, thought that if they identified as women, they'd have an easier life because, you know, not so many, I guess, scary fellow prison inmates. Also, they thought that they could opt out of some of the rehab classes that they had to do while they were still categorized as male offenders. So I'm just assuming that what that means is, if you've sexually assaulted people, you have to take, you know, classes as a male sexual assault person. And maybe you don't have to. If you say you're a woman, does that make sense? But there is also, again, this group of trans people saying that fakers harm their reputation and safety. And you can see how that probably would be the case if you're someone who's been just dysphoric your whole life and has lived your whole life as this person with dysphoria. And then someone just says, oh, yeah, me too, and then follows you into the women's spaces, right? Here's the quote from that study. There's this theme in the findings related to the participants having to prove their authenticity and also question how genuine or fake other transgender prisoners were. The researcher says participants described how the fakers were both a threat to the reputation of prisoners who were transitioning gender and also a threat to the limited resources available to them in custody. But again, you know, my issue with this is not that like some are fake and some are real, although that's an uncomfortable discussion. And it's increasingly uncomfortable because there's no burden of proof any longer. We used to have this burden of proof where you had to have been dysphoric for 2 years. You had to have displayed these certain markers. For whatever reason, we've decided that's not necessary anymore. And you can just identify with how you feel. And so now, you know, people are poking, like they're making a joke out of it. Like, just let me throw on some lipstick and say I'm a lady. Ricky Gervais, most recent episode of his, what's the name of his show? Afterlife. I have not seen it, but I watched the first two seasons. Sort of pokes fun at this, is just like, throw on a wig, call yourself trans, get all the perks, right? But again, you know, these lines are blurred, and there's this, we're framing this around men, though, biological men. Nowhere in the study are we saying, does this make it safe, less safe for women? And that I think is problematic, because the very study was done to protect only trans people and not the existing population. And so if we then replicate these studies in schools, then we're never going to look at how this affects the single sex population, or for lack of non-transgender people. I'm not going to use the word cis. Go ahead, David.
Is there any data showing it the other way, where trans men are going into men's prisons, like requesting that and not being women's prisons? Are we seeing that at all?
I have not seen it. I have not seen it. And I don't know why you would, right? Unless to get yourself
killed.
Right,
but that just proves the point that it would be better to be in a woman's prison.
True.
You know, whether you're man or female. I mean, if they're not requesting to go in with men, then that means something is obviously, you know, worse in the men's prison than women's prison.
Maybe. I watched one episode of Orange is the New Black and decided I was not in for that. So maybe that's true, maybe that's not. I don't know. I have done no field research. Now, you know, there's no winning this game of distinction of who's real and who's not. Like, it really just leaves us this option of creating a third space. And when former Scottish First Minister Nicola Sturgeon was asked how we know who is a safe trans person and who is not, she basically said, wait until they commit violence and then we'll see, which is like using a woman as bait. So, you know, even if we're talking about female prisoners, though, they still have human rights. And a lot of times when you put male sex offenders in these single sex spaces, it's the women who are already there who become less safe, not the already existing trans women. And it's the most powerless populations who are harmed by gender ID. This reminded me of this statement in April by the Black Women's Caucus. They released this statement against gender ideology because they say Black women and girls are a more vulnerable population, particularly in the United States, and therefore need safer spaces to be protected. They point out that 1 in 4 Black girls are sexually assaulted before the age of 18. 35% of Black women report physical abuse and violence. And so policies that allow men unfettered access to female designated facilities put Black women and girls, a demographic disproportionately impacted by male violence, at an even higher risk. Also, Black women are 2.5 times more likely to be murdered than men, by men than white women. And this is why the fight against gendered ideology is pertinent for Black women. This statement says we are the demographic most in need of protection from male violence. So when you think of how these studies are framed of how we can protect the trans people, we don't even look at it from which vulnerable populations will be at risk. We also know that Black people are more likely to be incarcerated in the U.S. So putting men in these prisons is another risk factor for Black women and girls. But new rules in the UK no longer allow biological men to self-identify into women's prisons. That doesn't mean this is the last of this debate that we've heard. But I'm interested to see this full study when it comes out, because, again, it's interesting in the fact that we're even allowing for this category of fakers. Right. I think it maybe makes the conversation even harder rather than easier. But at least there is this idea that there always historically has been a way to identify the pathology of gender dysphoria And we somehow have forgotten it. You know, it's clinical. It's been in the books for years and years. Trans activists just don't like it. And so they've thrown it out. So let us know what you think of that study in the chat below, and share it with your friends and like it if you have enjoyed this conversation or got something out of it. So we are in a minute going to move to a different platform if you're watching us on YouTube, because current rules on YouTube say that we cannot even look at academic studies that would suggest that something that this new study did suggest. Now, this study was put up for peer review and then swiftly taken down, not peer reviewed. I mean, again, the way it's supposed to work in academics is if you don't like something, you poke a bunch of holes in it and say why it's wrong. Academics won't even do this. One of the paper's authors is Peter McCullough. So if you've been following this space, you already know where I'm going with this, but we're going to take a good hard look at the data. Before we do that, though, I want to tell you about our friends over at Lear, because it's no secret that if you're tuned in, you know experts are predicting a recession heading our way. Layoffs are already happening, and the government is ready to print more money, further devaluing the U.S. dollar. While last year was terrible for most investors, 2023 could be even worse. That is, unless you were smart and invested in gold, then you were protected from loss while other investments fell. If the experts are right and we get hit with a recession, 2023 is looking even better for gold and silver investors. So if you're interested in investing in gold, then Lear can help you start purchasing precious metals or converting part of your IRA or 401k into a gold and silver IRA. So call Lear Capital today at 800-613-3557 or go to LearRedacted.com. Right now, if you buy 1 ounce of gold, Lear Capital is giving away a free ounce of silver. And that's incredible. Literally free silver. You can keep it. You can sell it. Do whatever you want. It's yours. There are a lot of gold companies to choose from, and Lear Capital has over 25 years of experience, thousands of five-star reviews, and a risk-free guarantee that gives you 24 hours to review your purchase before you commit to it. Lear Capital is a top choice when buying gold and silver, so call them at 800-613-3557 or go to LearRedacted.com and get your free gold and silver investor guides and receive up to $15,000 in free bonus medals with a qualified purchase. Once again, you can learn more by calling 800-613-3557 or go to LearRedacted.com. Okay, so we're saying so long to our crowd over at YouTube. Thank you very much for joining me. I will see you here tomorrow. Remember, Clayton's not back till next Monday, so one more show with me. Thank you for sticking out with me. I really, really appreciate it, and I appreciate all your comments and all of the speculation on why Clayton's not here. One person said, did you have a fight? Not that led to him not being on the show. I mean, we bicker all the time. We've been married for almost 13 years. But no, that's not why he's not here. He's not here because he's taken a break. He's taken a mini break. It's not a mini break. It's been a long break. And he will be back here on Monday. So thank you for watching us on YouTube. I'm saying goodbye. Over and out. All right, Rumble, alone at last. Here we are, we're alone at last. Okay, so we're not alone. David's laughing in my ear. Okay, it's really hot.
No, that's me, that's Philip.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, well, I was laughing too, just not in your ear.
Okay. Why are you laughing? Just to be silly.
Your little outro was, your little goodbye to YouTube was pretty funny.
Oh, on point. Okay. All right, thank you. I'm on a roll tonight. I'm on a roll. Okay, that was fizzy water, and it's making me a little. I apologize for that. Yeah,
you're allowed to do that on Rumble.
I can burp on Rumble.
You can burp. Yep. You can do that on fizzy Rumble. Lifting drinks. Okay. You can float to the ceiling. Whatever you want.
All right. One of my most popular videos during my first show, my first broadcast show was called Textra, and we would do outtakes and. I did armpit farts in the outtakes, and that it was semi-viral. You can find it yourself. I think it was called because it was under my maiden name, Natalie Del Conte, Textra Outtakes, and I was armpit farting. But okay, I was 28 at the time, and now I'm 43. No, I'm 44. How old am I? I'm 44. So I'm not going to do that right now. It's just too hot, too. But yeah, maybe some other time. All right, are you ready? This is not going to be fun, but we got to do it. It must be done. Because now we are on Rumble. I just want to remind you why we have to do this study on this platform, because we're going to talk about a study about COVID vaccine deaths that was published and then removed by The Lancet. How does this happen? You probably can guess. First of all, here's why we have to do this story on Rumble. Take a look at these are the current rules on Yes, that one. The current rules on YouTube that say that we cannot present misinformation that includes claims that an approved COVID-19 vaccine will cause death, infertility, miscarriage, autism, or other contraction of other infectious diseases. Now, I would argue that what we're about to talk about doesn't violate those rules because the COVID-19 vaccine was never fully approved. This word approved here gives us a loophole, but if we get punished on YouTube, which we have done before, we don't really get to contest. We can't show them that we're right and they're wrong. So we don't mess with that. We're just, homie, don't play that. So that's why we're here. I think it's interesting to know what things you are being prevented from seeing on that platform because we simply, you know, cannot present that information. So by YouTube standards, we would have to ignore this next published research. So here we are on a different platform, and we don't have to toss out inconvenient research. So here's the study. You can see the watermark there says that it has been submitted to The Lancet for peer review. And as soon as it was submitted for review, it was booted, kicked off the site. Now, what they're saying is, we feel pretty good about this. We've done this study. We think our conclusions are solid. Please go over it. Here, peers, review it. If you can poke holes in it, do that. They won't even do it. Lancet publishers removed the study and replaced it with this statement. This preprint has been removed by preprints with The Lancet because the study's conclusions are not supported by the study methodology. Okay, but this is a review of existing studies. It is a valid research methodology to take existing studies and then go through them and parse them out. There are a lot of research review papers on The Lancet in this, you know, in every issue. We've covered many of them, but they're saying that they don't think those conclusions are supported by that type of methodology. And they, that, I mean, a peer review, most of the time a peer review, when you get that back, you get very detailed notes about where they got wrong. This is just a like, nope, goodbye, red stamp, out. What we've been saying is that this study was kicked off The Lancet because they said that the conclusions were not supported by the study's methodology. Whereas normally, if that was, if they were really going to take this on, they would give them detailed notes and why they thought that this was not supported. We're never going to get any kind of real reason why they think that these conclusions were not supported by the methodology. But here's one of the authors of the study, Dr. Peter McCullough, who's been on the show many times, describing his findings from this paper.
We arrived at 44 papers, 325 autopsies. Then we took each one of the autopsy results out and we put it as a single line item with all the clinical description. And then we submitted that to adjudication, a blind adjudication. And we found that 73.9% of all the cases, it was either the vaccine as the direct cause of death or it significantly contributed to the death. The deaths occurred within a week or two after taking the last shot. And far more than 50%, the single cause was a cardiovascular cause of death.
Why do you say that this blows the existing narrative out of the water? What is the true significance of what you found here?
The CDC and the FDA at this point in time, the official narrative, is they still don't see any evidence that deaths are linked to the vaccine. And they have begrudgingly acknowledged a few cases after the Janssen vaccine, for instance. So the government narrative is still that people do not die after COVID-19 vaccination. And now we have the largest series of autopsies, and the autopsies really are incontrovertible. The patients are, you know, did die of the vaccine. So it does blow the government narrative out of the water. They're going to have to wrestle with this. It garnered tremendous attention, certainly on the internet, social media, and the editorial platforms.
All right. So specifically, what they found in this paper, if you would like to read it, is that close to 74% of the deaths that they reviewed could be attributed to COVID vaccine because they occurred within 1 week of vaccination. This totaled 240 deaths in total. The most common cause of was organ failure post-vaccine, and the organ systems were the cardiovascular system, followed by hematological system, the respiratory system, and multiple organ systems. Now, this tracks with Pfizer's own early vaccine trials that we covered from the period of vaccination starting in December 2020, until I believe we had the data into early 2021. And we saw all of these adverse events. So we know that this is not out of the ordinary. It's not surprising that these events happen and some people die from them. So we shouldn't be surprised that, yes, those things also can cause death. Now, what happens when we ignore these things? Well, one, we allow the CDC to continue and the FDA to continue to approve drugs without clinical trials. That's one. Also, we refuse to then treat ongoing adverse events with people who are still living and living with this adverse events. The study points out that those with ongoing adverse events are left out in the cold with the medical community. They're not trying to help them because we pretend they don't exist because they're inconvenient, sort of like detransitioners. Like, well, can't help you because that's inconvenient. So there's no one to help you there. You know, once you break this group, think you're kind of on your own. They point out that, you know, we continue to have high rates of cancer post-vaccination rollout, high rates of all types of unexpected deaths and cancers and diseases. And we're not helping if we don't look at this data at all. So it's one thing to refute this study. It's another to actually peer review it, say where it's wrong, and then identify populations that will need continued help. But the fact that The Lancet just kicked it off the site and won't do that means they don't want you to see it and they don't want to admit or review anything inside of it. They lack curiosity, I would say. So let us know what you think of that. We have linked to the paper in the newsletter this morning so you can read it yourself. It still exists online, but not clearly not on The Lancet. A lot of times this has the adverse, the sort of reverse effect of people being more aware of it when it's kicked off a medical review site. That does seem to be happening online, but nobody who wants to ignore it is going to take a look at it. You know, we have a culture that makes it very easy to ignore inconvenient truths. So let us know what you think of that. That's going to do it for us today. I will be back tomorrow and we'll look into this reason that we keep dropping the show at this certain time of night. Hopefully it's not on our end, but we come back.
I swear it's not me. I'm not hitting the button.
Okay.
I swear.
Yeah, last night, Philip cut us out before our full goodbye. So I'm going to give you a full long goodbye. Come in for a hug. Come on.
Let's get a Clayton goodbye.
What's a Clayton goodbye?
You know how he keeps going and you're like, okay, let's go.
Oh, yeah. When he puts his hands together like this on the left side and he's and I'm like, shut up. That's enough. And that's when we do have a fight and that's why he's not here. No. We do sometimes bicker after the show about certain things. I'm like, did you have to do that? But mostly it's good. Not too passionate of fights. Well, sometimes, but that's not for you to know. Okay. Anyway, that's enough. Natalie's being naughty and I'm gonna turn it in now. So thank you again for watching the show. We will see you here tomorrow. One more solo Natalie show and then you get your team back. So thank you for sticking with us. We'll see you here tomorrow, everybody. Good night.